Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
We can have the future we want, but we have to work for it.
You're listening to Soonish. I'm Wade Rausch. If you want to relive one of the most chilling moments in recent political history, it's easy to hop on YouTube and find this clip from the final presidential debate of 2016 between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, with Chris Wallace as the moderator.
I want to ask you here on the stage tonight, do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time.
There is a tradition in this country. In fact, one of the prides of this country is the peaceful transition of power, and that no matter how hard fought a campaign is, that at the end of the campaign, that the loser concedes to the winner and that the country comes together in part for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Well, okay? Chris, let me respond to that, because that's horrifying. You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
This is a mindset. This is how Donald thinks. And it's funny, but it's also really troubling.
Of course, we all know how that election turned out. Clinton won the popular vote by a margin of almost 3 million votes. But she lost in the Electoral College, after capturing just 227 electoral votes to Trump's 304. So Clinton did the traditional thing and conceded. But when she said this is how Donald thinks, she may not have known how right she was. On his third day in office in January 2017, after an election he'd just won, Trump still claimed the vote was rigged. He told members of Congress that the only reason he'd lost the popular vote was that 3 to 5 million people had voted illegally. The claim was outlandish on its face, and later, not even the president's own advisory committee on election integrity was able to substantiate it. There was one person who watched the debate that night in October 2016 who couldn't stop replaying that moment in his head.
Chris Wallace was rather taken aback, and Hillary Clinton was horrified. And I remember thinking, like, that's a pretty remarkable thing for the candidate of a major party to be saying.
That's Lawrence Douglas. He's a professor in the Department of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College in Western Massachusetts. He's known for his books about how the international legal system dealt with Nazi war crimes after World War II. More recently, he's been writing regular op-eds for The Guardian about the Trump administration's legal travails. And when I talked with him last week, Professor Douglas told me that "I'll keep you in suspense" moment from Trump in the debate left a nagging question in his mind.
Whatever damage a candidate could cause to our system by refusing to concede, imagine the kind of damage that an incumbent could cause to our system by refusing to concede. And then I asked myself, well, how well equipped is our system to deal with that type of eventuality? And I think the rather disappointing or rather alarming conclusion, I should say, is it's very poorly equipped indeed. In fact, I might go one step further and say that should such a crisis arise, the system is more likely to exacerbate it than to diffuse it.
Now, Douglas has published a whole book on that question under the title, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. I read it in one sitting. And I asked Douglas to talk with me for the podcast because I see the book as a great example of what you might call political futurism. We all know about the fundamental flaw in the U.S. Constitution that makes it possible for a presidential candidate to win in the Electoral College without winning a plurality of the popular vote. After all, that's happened 4 times in our nation's history, twice in this century alone. But Douglas's book goes beyond that problem to explore a bunch of other scenarios where the bad design baked into our election system could lead to a total system failure this November. By system failure, I mean, for example, an election where we get to Inauguration Day in 2021 and we still don't know who's been elected president. Or a scenario where Trump has clearly lost the election, but claims the vote was rigged and refuses to leave office. What we're learning is that the system of laws and norms around elections wasn't built to handle somebody like Trump, who doesn't care about norms, and who in fact has been rewarded over and over for breaking them. What could happen if somebody like that tried to push the system even farther beyond its limits?
I read some catastrophe theory, and I read that people who do catastrophe theory, what they usually do is they take the likelihood of an event, and then they multiply it by the amount of harm that would result if that catastrophe does materialize. So that even if the likelihood is quite low, if the harm that results is quite high, then it's something we really should prepare ourselves for. And so when I started writing it, I actually was working from the assumption that Trump was probably going to be reelected. He seemed like he was in a pretty good position to win reelection. And so I did think of this sort of as somewhat of a thought experiment of, well, maybe we should prepare ourselves for this eventuality because, again, of the harm that could result. But now what seemed quite theoretical seems, unfortunately, quite possible come November 3rd.
Now, dear listeners, before I dive into my full conversation with Lawrence Douglas, I want to be upfront about something. This episode gets pretty dark. Very, very dark. But I'm not trying to scare or shock anybody, and I don't think Douglas is either. The point of Soonish has always been to share stories that help us think about the future and where we want to take it. When people ask me for my own predictions about the future, I usually say I'm a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist, meaning I think things are probably going to get worse before they get better. Right now, it's the summer of 2020, and the coronavirus pandemic is still raging. The global economy is in a smoldering heap. Thanks to climate change, this could easily turn out to be the hottest summer on record. And we have a president who's basically a walking bottle of charcoal lighter fluid. Yet, at the same time, the nation's caught up in the most intense movement in more than half a century to defeat systemic racism and end police violence toward people of color. And as I speak, the Supreme Court has just handed down some astonishing decisions that will improve the lives of immigrants and LGBTQ people. So, speaking for myself, I'm simultaneously feeling more hope for the future than I have in a long time, and more dread. I mean, it's amazing to see so many people rising up to demand real change. On the flip side, our institutions are so worn down and so rickety, and people are so angry and so unable to agree on anything, that it's hard to imagine that change coming easily or peacefully. Under conditions like this, it's easy to imagine how the elections this November could turn ugly. And that's why I wanted to talk with Lawrence Douglas. Because even if you can't stop a disaster, you can mentally prepare for one. I started off the conversation by asking Professor Douglas to explain why he wrote the book and what kind of result he's hoping for.
I suppose on one level, you know, I'm just trying to issue a warning to Americans saying that our system is vulnerable to a real meltdown. You might then ask, well, how do we avoid that kind of meltdown scenario? I think at times I've described it as there's sort of like a Chernobyl-like defect that's kind of built into our electoral system that, again, if everything kind of lines up in the right way or I suppose the wrong way, this meltdown could occur. And I would suppose at the very least, I would hope that the book might encourage people to get out and vote. I do think that the best way to avoid a meltdown in the fall is to hand Trump a decisive defeat. I do feel that if he's beaten decisively, his opportunities to engage in constitutional brinkmanship will be very dramatically limited. And then I suppose the other interest is by kind of laying out these possible nightmare scenarios is to hopefully stimulate some type of, you know, legislative changes further on down the line.
From everything that Trump has tweeted and said, it's a pretty good prediction that if he were defeated narrowly in November, he would refuse to concede. What would constitute a clear and emphatic victory by Biden? Like, how many electoral college votes would he need to make you feel comfortable that any sort of resistance would fail?
Let's say he receives 300 electoral college votes. So 270 is needed for victory. He receives 300. Is that a landslide? By no means is it a landslide. But if it's the case that in all the, let's say, states in which the outcome was relatively close, that he nevertheless wins decisively in those states. And but decisively, again, I'm not talking about super majorities. I'm talking about if he wins, let's say, 52% of the vote to 48% of the vote, that's a decisive victory. It's very hard to argue that that margin has been the result of, you know, fraudulent mail-in ballots. So I think that kind of margin of victory would secure us from the kind of mayhem that Trump could cause.
Douglas says what he's more worried about is a scenario where Biden wins in the Electoral College, but with a smaller margin of victory in the key states that have lots of electoral votes.
If Biden has 300 Electoral College votes, but they're all turning on 10,000 vote victory in Wisconsin, 15,000 vote victory in Pennsylvania, 15,000 vote victory in Michigan, all of those will be challenged. And not only challenged by attorneys, but here's also the real danger is they also kind of lend themselves that kind of razor slim margin of victory. It lends itself to the kind of conspiracy theories that Trump, you know, has patented as, you know, part of his political strategy.
I totally get that. And I agree with you that the easiest way to head off a disaster would be just to make sure that everyone votes and that the election outcome is as clear as possible. But there's still part of me that feels like, geez, that just feels so undemocratic in a way. I mean, he's basically creating a situation where you need like almost a supermajority, a super convincing majority to head off the possibility of conspiracy theorizing and grousing and legal challenges. And that's just not the way the system should work.
That's an absolutely brilliant and terrific point. It's not like, oh, well, only if you receive 60 votes and I receive 40, do I then recognize that you've won. That's not the way a democratic system is meant to operate. And I think you're absolutely right that in a sense, that's what Trump has done. He's kind of moved the goalposts. And it's an incredibly dangerous thing for a president to be doing.
So I do want people to read the book, but I'd also like you to maybe give away a little bit of it by summarizing what you see as the biggest vulnerabilities in the Electoral College system itself. And so things like the possibility of faithless electors, the possibility of states certifying competing sets of electors. Can you walk us through what you see as some of the biggest flaws in the system?
Yeah, I should preface this by saying I find the system incredibly flawed. The Electoral College is an anachronistic and arguably, you know, dysfunctional way to choose a president. And there's no way that if we were trying to come up with a new method of electing a president, we'd come up with anything that remotely looks like the Electoral College. You mentioned the business about faithless electors. Maybe I'll just start with them for a moment. So if you actually go back and look at the original design of the Electoral College, the framers of the Constitution really didn't trust average people to choose who the president should be. They really figured that people wouldn't have enough information about national political figures, and as a result of that ignorance, that choice couldn't be safely given to the American public. And so they figured, well, we'll hand it to this body of electors who are meant to be people of higher standing, of, you know, high profile within their society, who are able to engage in a reasoned deliberation as to who should be our chief executive. That original logic of the system disappeared very, very quickly. And now we basically have the system in which the electors are figureheads who simply put a rubber stamp on whoever wins the popular vote within the state. And of course, it's a winner-take-all system. So if you can eke out a victory, a popular vote victory in a particular state, you get all of that state's Electoral College votes. And the electors, they meet, you know, in early December, mid-December, and they kind of engage in this kind of ceremonial function in which they place a rubber stamp on the results of the popular vote. That's how they should act, but they don't necessarily have to. So there is this problem of the faithless elector. And the faithless elector simply means that the elector who decides, yeah, I was pledged to Hillary Clinton, but I don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. I want to vote for John Kasich. For example, this happened in Colorado in 2016, where there were three Colorado electors who decided that they were trying to find an alternative to Donald Trump. And they thought, well, maybe John Kasich could be the alternative. So rather than vote for Hillary Clinton, who won that state, they tried to cast their votes for John Kasich. And then you might say, well, are they allowed to do that? Can they do that? And the answer is, Well, we'll find out in the next few days because the Supreme Court is about to hand down a decision. Again, the first time it's ever decided this in the nation's entire history, but they're trying to decide whether laws that bind electors are constitutional or not. It looks like, I mean, if I were a betting person, I would probably say, yes, the Supreme Court is going to uphold those laws. They're going to uphold laws which say that states can try to force people, electors, to vote according to the way they were pledged to vote.
I'm going to hit pause here and jump in with an update. I recorded my interview with Lawrence Douglas on June 19th, and I published the original version of this episode on June 25th. On July 5th, the Supreme Court did indeed rule on a pair of faithless elector cases from Washington State and Colorado. The court said unanimously that states do indeed have the power to punish or replace electors who change their votes. If the ruling had gone the other way, it would have freed electors to vote for whomever they want, which would have undermined an already creaky system and unleashed certain chaos this November. So at least we don't have to worry about that scenario. But as you're about to hear from Douglas, the court's decision doesn't solve the underlying problem. Okay, now back to our June 19th interview.
And then you might say, okay, well then that solves the whole faithless elector problem. And the answer is no, it doesn't at all. And the reason it doesn't solve the faithless elector problem is because, firstly, there are 18 states that don't have any penalties at all if an elector votes faithlessly. So, and some of these states include our key swing states, such as Pennsylvania. And then the states that do have some kind of penalty, some of them, they leave the faithless vote intact, but they simply fine the elector. So an elector receives a $1,000 slap on the wrist, and yet the vote continues to count. Not a good way to decide a presidential election.
What's a scenario where faithless electors could play a role in thwarting a legitimate victory by Biden in November?
You could imagine a situation of, so let's say Biden wins with the kind of very slim margin that George W. Bush had in the year 2000. So he gets 271 electoral college votes. And yet he wins pretty decisively in every state. So he carries, let's say, Michigan by 52 to 48%. But when it comes time for Michigan's electors, that is the slate that is committed to Biden, on December 14th, when they meet in Lansing, in the state capitol, to ceremonially cast their votes, for some reason, two of the electors cast their vote for SpongeBob. Suddenly, Biden then has 269 electoral college votes and not 271. 269 is not an electoral college majority. He has not been elected president of the United States. And again, you might say, well, could we prosecute these people? Yes, we could prosecute them. Can we get rid of their vote? Let's say Congress, when Congress meets on January 6th, so Congress gets their electoral certificate from Michigan on January 6th. And again, this is meant to be a ceremonial function on the part of Congress. They open the electoral certificates, they count it up. Usually this lasts about half an hour. Everyone kind of goes home, but they open up Michigan's electoral certificate and they see that two of the electors have voted for SpongeBob. And now they say, that's completely crazy. We're not going to count those electors. We're just going to expunge them from the total. What does that mean? Does that mean you expunge them from the numerator? And the numerator means what describes the electoral majority. So he no longer has 271, he has 269. Do you also expunge that from the denominator? If we, again, do our very fancy math, it seems that 269 would still be a majority of 536, but a 269 would not be a majority of 538, which is what would happen if you don't remove them from the denominator. So we're back to this key critical question. We go running to the Constitution and we see the Constitution doesn't tell us what the consequences of expunging an electoral college vote are. So then you run to federal law, and there's a federal law from 1887. And this federal law from 1887 is called the Electoral Count Act. Well, that sounds very promising. And we flip through the pages of the Electoral Count Act to discover what it says about the consequences of expunging an electoral college vote. And what does it say? It says absolutely nothing. It doesn't tell us either. And so at that point, you have presumably the House, which is controlled by Democrats, saying that, well, expunging the votes, you have to eliminate them from the denominator as well, handing Biden the victory. And the Senate comes along and says, no, no, we don't recognize that. You expunge them only from the numerator. The denominator remains 538. We don't have a president-elect.
Now, closely related to that scenario, and potentially even simultaneous with that scenario, you can imagine one where Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat of Michigan, submits her certified electoral votes to Congress on January 6th, but the state legislature of Michigan, which is controlled by Republicans, submits a competing slate of electors. So the problem then becomes, for Congress on January 6th, which one of these slates is the quote-unquote real one? And you're sort of right back in the same situation, right, where the House, controlled by Democrats, might favor Whitmer's slate and the Senate might favor the legislators' slate.
Yeah, and if I can just expound a little bit about how that could happen. And I think that is probably a greater danger come this fall than the faithless elector danger. Again, the faithless elector is a possibility, absolutely is a possibility. But I think the far bigger danger has to do with the competing certificates being sent from the legislature and the governor. And the reason I say that could easily happen is because of the increased reliance on mail-in ballots. And if I can just quickly connect these points.
Yeah, please do.
We've already seen that Trump is engaged in this kind of preemptive attack on the use of mail-in ballots. And your listeners might be asking, why is he so obsessed with mail-in ballots as opposed to other forms of balloting? Well, come this fall, it is clearly the case that people in urban areas are going to be concerned about exposing themselves to the health risks of voting in person. And as a result of that, they're going to rely very heavily on mail-in ballots. People in urban areas tend to vote overwhelmingly Democratic. So to the extent that you can either, one, limit their access to mail-in ballots, or try to delegitimate the use of mail-in ballots, you're already trying, in a sense, to kind of push the vote in a Republican direction. Now, the way that could play out on November 3rd is you could imagine that, let's go back to a state like Michigan, that in Michigan, come November 3rd, Trump has a very narrow popular vote lead. Let's say he's leading by 10,000 votes on November 3rd. Well, another critical feature about the use of mail-in ballots is that mail-in ballots are usually not tallied until days or even weeks after the election, especially if these overworked election officials are being inundated with a huge number of mail-in ballots come, you know, election day or the couple days after election day. So Trump already declares victory on November 3rd. He has this narrow lead. And then come, let's make a date, November, a week later, November 10th or November 15th, once Michigan finishes counting all its mail-in ballots, that lead has disappeared. And now it's Biden who leads by 20,000 votes. Now, one other thing I would add to our little complicated scenario here is there are going to be irregularities in the counting of mail-in ballots. There are irregularities in the counting of all votes. Again, you're working with overworked people, undertrained people who are going to make what we might describe as harmless errors. But once they make those harmless errors, you will have Trump tweeting aggressively that we can no longer trust the post-election result. We have to go with the November 3rd result. And again, you might say, oh, well, here, isn't this the professor just kind of spinning out hypotheticals? And the answer is no. He already did this in 2018. In 2018, in the Florida senatorial race, Rick Scott had a pretty substantial lead on election day and saw that lead almost vanish as the mail-in ballots in urban areas were counted. And we saw Trump aggressively tweeting that we have to go with the election day result. We can't trust the count that includes these mail-in ballots. They're all tainted with fraud. it's very possible and likely that he would trot out that same argument in November. Now, this goes back to the earlier point that you made, Wade, is that you can imagine Republican state legislators agreeing with him, saying in Michigan that, yes, we're going to go with November 3rd, not with the full canvassing of the votes that didn't take place until November 15th. So we're going to certify Trump's slate of electors, and we're going to send that to Congress. And then again, you could have Gretchen Whitmer coming along and saying, no, I'm going to recognize the full state canvass, the results that we received in, let's say, November 15th. I'm going to recognize Biden's slate of electors, and I'm going to send that slate on to Congress. And again, it's a little technical, but now Congress is receiving conflicting electoral certificates with the overall election hanging in the balance. And that really is a recipe for chaos, stalemate, gridlock.
Now, you can imagine that if we had a functioning Congress, there'd be a debate over the conflicting electoral certificates, leading to some kind of compromise. But, of course, that's not the Congress we have. And the Republican Party, specifically, seems to operate inside a kind of force field of unreality that's created and sustained by the president. So there's a chapter where you draw a very useful distinction that I really liked, and it was a distinction between what you called Trump's sort of first-order lies, which are just matters of simple untruth, and what you call meta-lies. So could you explain that a little more? What do you mean by meta-lies?
The simple, straightforward lies are when he claims that something happened that didn't happen, or something didn't happen that did happen. But the meta-lies is when he lies about the institutions within our society that are meant to test normal propositions for their truth value. So, for example, when you lie about, if you say something like the New York Times is making stories up, well, then what you're doing is you're discrediting the very institutions within a democracy that are responsible for basically subjecting our ordinary statements to verification. And that is a really dangerous situation, because if you are both not telling the truth and not telling the truth about the institutions that are supposed to be testing whether you tell the truth, then basically you have eroded all faith in truth-testing mechanisms within a democracy. And a democracy presupposes that citizens make informed choices. And if you deny them access to any kind of source that can supply them with reliable information by impugning the reputation of that source, then basically you're the source of truth. And I think that's what Trump tries to do. He tries to install himself as the voice of truth. And for tens of millions of Americans, they seem to accept that.
And one of the ways this could apply in November is that the fact that Trump is not just a good liar, but a really good meta liar, could go to the thing we were just talking about, the mail-in ballot question, for example. The harder he works to undermine faith in the integrity of the absentee ballot or mail-in ballot system, the easier it would be for him to question the outcome of those votes as they roll in after November 3rd, right?
Exactly. And because once you start poisoning the well, once we start saying, look, we don't know who to trust. You know, I do think it's the case that tens of millions of Americans trust Trump. But I think that what is so destabilizing about both these lies and meta lies is that they basically say, we just don't know who to trust. And if we don't need to know who to trust, then we can't necessarily trust the organs who are saying, no, these mail-in ballots are reliable. Believe us. And that is an incredibly dangerous situation for a democracy to find itself in.
Okay, up to this point, we've been talking about the way the design flaws baked into the Electoral College system could come back to bite us this fall. And I wanted to ask you to walk through with me three additional scenarios or three kinds of factors that could be additional spoilers or make the situation even worse. So the first one, and this is one that I've talked about before on the show, is breakdowns in the election system itself. We just saw in the primary elections in Georgia how voting machine problems caused gigantic lines that lasted all day. I don't know if anyone was actually turned away from the voting places, but certainly it was way harder to vote than it should have been in the regions in and around Atlanta, which, it goes without saying, are predominantly Democratic. So do you see the Georgia situation as a potential preview of the kinds of chaos that could unfold on November 3rd?
Absolutely. We have, you know, 8,000, more than 8,000 different little election districts in the United States. And again, if you're talking about a very tight race, you know, arguably you could say the entire system is only as secure as the weakest link. So yeah, I mean, you could easily imagine not simply long lines. You have new technologies being trotted out that fail. You could imagine even, you know, a power failure, and that power failure could be a result of a natural disaster. It could be a result of a foreign adversary hacking into our electoral grid. And again, that power failure doesn't have to roll across the United States. It could be concentrated in Wayne County in Michigan, where Detroit is, again, heavily black area that votes overwhelmingly Democratic. And then what happens? Can you stage a revote? What does our federal law say about that? It doesn't say anything about that. And we really don't necessarily have contingency plans to deal with a problem like that. And these problems are very, very real. And again, in the best of circumstances, they could create chaos. And then when you have a president like Trump, you could imagine things turning out very, very badly after November 3rd.
Okay, you already touched on my spoiler scenario number two, but it's about interference by Russia or other foreign actors, whether that means through social media disinformation campaigns like we saw in 2016, or something a little more bold and frontal like cyber attacks on the infrastructure or on voting machines. Do you see anybody taking convincing action to prepare for those possibilities?
You know, there are certainly obviously Americans, and there are certainly people within the Trump administration who take those concerns seriously. I don't think Trump himself takes the concerns particularly seriously. But the question is, there's a big difference between taking those concerns seriously and having the resources on the ground to make sure that they don't cause potentially devastating damage to our system. And we simply haven't invested in those resources. And incredibly, it seems like even the integrity of our electoral system, which you would think, well, maybe that would be an example of an issue around which you could gain bipartisan support. Lo and behold, no. Mitch McConnell was very, very reluctant to release federal monies so that states could upgrade their electoral systems to make them less vulnerable to fraud and to hacking. It is a case that the American electoral system is less vulnerable than it was in 2016, but it still remains highly vulnerable. But the best way to safeguard the system is to make sure that you have paper ballot backup to whatever kind of electronic voting takes place. I think in 2016, one out of every four ballots that were cast had no paper backup. I think that number now is down to about 1 in 10. So that's certainly an improvement. But when you're talking about 1 in 10, if you're talking about small margins of victory, all you need is to have a foreign adversary target these vulnerable systems, and they have the capacity to create a great deal of chaos.
And then scenario number three is the one where the COVID-19 pandemic continues to roll on, that there are still lots of people concerned about going outdoors, going to public places, being inside polling places.
Right. I think the COVID pandemic situation makes it worrisome in two separate ways. One, if you go back to, for example, this vote that took place in Wisconsin in April, and that was for the primary and also for some state elections, we saw that of the 180 polling places that were meant to be open in Milwaukee, only five were open. And so that arguably is a way of disenfranchising thousands of people if they're unable to kind of get to the polling places. People could just get tired. They could walk away. They could be unwilling to subject themselves to the health risks. And then we have the problem with the mail-in ballot. So you might have, again, a huge number of people relying on mail-in ballots rather than voting in person. So again, that's the way in which the pandemic really can contribute to a lot of chaos come November 3rd.
In his book, Douglas quotes a legal scholar at Yale named Jack Balkin, who wrote, quote, "The central task of constitutions is to keep disagreement within the bounds of ordinary politics, rather than breaking down into anarchy, violence, or civil war," unquote. So I asked Douglas if he could imagine a scenario where disagreement about the election outcome went outside the bounds of ordinary politics. K. Can you imagine a scenario where either Trump supporters or Biden supporters put their feet down and say, no, that's not fair and we're not going to live with it? And how bad could things get in that scenario?
You're absolutely right to think that this is a source of real concern. And the other thing I think I would emphasize is that just in recent weeks, we saw two very, I think, disturbing examples of failures of presidential leadership, or not even failures of presidential leadership. I think probably more accurate to say of a kind of authoritarian impulse manifesting itself in a way that could herald very bad things come the fall. The first was in order to gain political points against Democratic governors in some of these swing states. We saw that Trump tweeted out, liberate Wisconsin, liberate Michigan. And again, it was not as if he was making an argument for violence, but we saw the way in which his supporters kind of responded to that. And we had these incredibly disturbing images of, you know, heavily armed people in the state house, not simply protesting outside, but inside the state capitals with, you know, their automatic weapons. The other thing we saw, which I thought was very disturbing, was the willingness of the president to call on the military for the purposes of responding to protests in the wake of George Floyd's murder. And we saw that, you know, but for Attorney General Barr and for Defense Secretary Mark Esper, it seemed that Trump was willing to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807. So, yes, I do think that the opportunities for unrest are real. We don't need to overlook the fact that, you know, this is a country whose populace is armed to the teeth, and that is very easy to imagine that conflicts, demonstrations and counter-demonstrations end up in violence. And I don't want to say that I would imagine Trump necessarily encouraging violence, but again, it's this kind of dog whistle politics that he engages in, this politics of divide and tear down. So all you need to do is, you know, send out a tweet along the lines of the radical Democrats are trying to steal our victory. And who knows how people are going to interpret that.
So you finished writing your book way before George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis and before the nationwide uprisings over systemic racism that we've been seeing in the last few weeks. I think that movement has shown a willingness by average citizens to rise up in protest on a scale that we haven't really seen since the 60s. It's harder for me now to imagine Trump being allowed to steal the election without causing millions or tens of millions of people to show up in Washington or in New York or in other population centers to protest and make it harder for him to stay in office. But as you just noted, in that scenario, it's also all too easy to imagine counter-demonstrations where you have people from the Boogaloo movement showing up, as they're already doing at Black Lives Matter rallies, right, with weapons. So that feels like democracy in action, but it also feels like a recipe for a bloodbath.
Yeah, and again, I share your concerns entirely. And, you know, I do think that it's important to point out that, you know, the counter demonstrators, it's not as if they're just anti-Biden. That wouldn't be the point. The counter demonstrators would be saying, no, our president has been reelected and the Democrats are trying to, in a sense, stage a coup. Whereas Biden supporters could be saying exactly opposite. No, Biden has been elected and Trump is trying to stage a coup. And, you know, my hope is that you would have, you know, the political leadership trying to bring people together and trying to unify the nation and trying to walk back the specter or the possibility or the reality of violence. I'm not sure if we would really see Trump engaging in that kind of aggressive walking back. He never fails to miss an opportunity to unite the nation.
Now, I should point out here that on June 12th, Fox News journalist Harris Faulkner asked Trump the Chris Wallace question, which is now also the Lawrence Douglas question. If he loses the election, will he go? And this time, Trump's response was different.
Certainly, if I don't win, I don't win. I mean, you know, I go on and do other things. I think it would be a very sad thing for our country.
I asked Douglas whether he found any comfort in that answer.
Not entirely, no. What we've seen is why attack the integrity of these mail-in ballots if you're not already trying to create some kind of narrative to be trotted out come the fall. So no, I don't find his reassurance particularly comforting. And the other thing we should probably mention is, you know, he's offered reassuring statements about other things in the past. You know, at some point someone asks him, so President Trump, do you believe up is up? And he's, of course I believe up is up. Who would say up is down? No one would say that. And then 2 days later, it's up is down. It's only the failing New York Times. It's only the fake news people are saying that up is up. Don't trust those people. So no, I'm not comforted at this moment.
I went on to ask Douglas what he thinks we can do now, here in 2020, to prevent or mitigate the kinds of problems he warns about in the book. His first answer was pretty obvious. Line up the votes to make sure that the election has a decisive outcome. He also pointed out that it would change things dramatically if Democrats captured 3 or 4 of the Senate seats currently held by Republicans, since it would be the new Senate, not the current one, that would be deliberating in the faithless elector or competing elector scenarios. A smaller thing that might still make a difference would be for political journalists and TV newscasters to stop treating election night like it's a horse race where the winner is the first past the post. We already know it's going to take days or weeks to count all the mail-in ballots. So the job of the John Kings and Wolf Blitzers and Anderson Coopers of the world should be to remind viewers that the results coming in on the night of November 3rd are provisional, not final. That could help prevent either candidate from trying to write off the mail-in ballots and declare victory prematurely. But those are all short-term strategies. In the longer term, the only way to fix the fundamental design problems that Douglas writes about would be to go back to the Constitution itself and the body of election law that surrounds it. You point out in the book that the Constitution doesn't guarantee a peaceful succession of power. It presupposes a peaceful succession of power, which means basically it relies on the goodwill, the wisdom of leaders, politicians, and the power of democratic norms. Is there any way to encode that kind of stuff more deeply in the Constitution?
I'm not sure that there really is. You know, there are ways to maybe change and amend this Electoral Count Act of 1887 so that, for example, if we have this kind of technical numerator-denominator problem that I described, that we get a clear answer to that, that would be helpful. But again, I think that it's like any kind of system. I don't think any kind of system can legislate its own normative basis. It has to be the way people are kind of socialized into accepting the system. There has to be kind of a constitutional culture. There are other things, you know, that we could probably do. We could probably change our way of electing the president. That would be a helpful thing to do. But that would also be an exceptionally difficult thing to do. Because if there's one thing in our Constitution which is as dysfunctional as the Electoral College itself, it's the way of amending the Constitution. Article 5 of the Constitution, which articulates how you go about amending the Constitution, the amendment process is just too hard. And it would be virtually impossible to amend away the Electoral College.
You know, there's this old saying in American legal discourse that the Constitution is not a suicide pact.
Exactly.
But it kind of feels like it is sometimes.
Justice Jackson said, however you interpret the Constitution, you shouldn't interpret it as a suicide pact. And yes, and then sometimes it seems that, I mean, for all its greatness, there are some really very dysfunctional aspects of the Constitution.
My final question for Douglas was about, well, I guess you could call it the silver lining question. If the deep design flaws in the Electoral College are exposed in a catastrophic way, do you think that might create the spark that would be needed for some kind of fundamental reform?
I do have hope that there could be enough support for a legislative fix. And the kind of legislative fix I imagine, and again, this is something which many, many people are working on. It's a very promising approach. And the approach is to have states pledge to award their electoral college votes, not to the statewide popular vote winner, but to the national popular vote winner. And if you get states that represent at least 270 electoral college votes to sign on to that pact, then you've in a sense made a legislative end run around the electoral college. Now we're back to this notion of the suicide pact, because arguably that kind of scheme, there were people who would argue that that's unconstitutional. But again, I think too much is at stake for us to interpret the Constitution in such a crabbed fashion that we would rather see fidelity to the Constitution and catastrophic electoral results than a sort of relaxed approach to reading the Constitution that permits us to experiment with a way of electing the president, which is A, more democratic, and B, less vulnerable to a spectacular failure.
The formal name for the plan Douglas is describing is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, or NPVIC. So far, 15 states have joined the compact, representing 196 electoral votes. Once that number reaches 270, all the states in the compact would start pledging their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. And that would be enough to guarantee that the popular vote winner always wins the presidency. That would be the end run around the Electoral College that Douglas was talking about. Of course, it's all a giant kludge, and it won't happen in time to help us here in 2020. But it does seem a lot more achievable than amending the Constitution. Let's be clear. When a system is as dangerous and as obsolete as the Electoral College, it shouldn't take a kludge or a catastrophe or a second civil war to fix it. On the other hand, it kind of seems like that's the American way. Eventually, one way or another, the Trump era will end. That end could come as soon as January 20th, 2021. But speaking for myself, I'm bracing for a longer wait. Like I said, I'm a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. So I have a very simple hope. It's that we don't allow Trump to shred every last notion of sanity, civility, equality, and decency. Because we're going to need them to start the long process of rebuilding. Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. Our opening theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. All of the other music in this episode is from Title Card Music and Sound in Boston. You can follow the show on Twitter at Soonish Podcast. And at our website, soonishpodcast.org, you can find the show notes and a transcript for this episode, as well as a link to Lawrence Douglas's book, Will He Go? If you live in one of the states where the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is still pending before the state legislature, one option would be to find out where your legislators stand and let them know how you feel about it. Right now, those states are New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, Georgia, Ohio, Missouri, and Minnesota. You can also get in touch with groups like Common Cause that are working to advance the project. To support Soonish with a per-episode donation, please go to patreon.com/soonish and check out all the cool rewards we have at different levels. Every dollar you give helps keep this independent podcast going strong. Soonish is one of 10 independent podcasts that have banded together over the past 3 years to form the Hub and Spoke audio collective. And this week, I want to tell you about a new episode from one of the founding Hub and Spoke shows, Ministry of Ideas. It's called Climate of Denial, and it asks why so many people see climate change not as the scientific fact it is, but as a belief that they can somehow opt out of. Host Zachary Davis locates that belief in some unexpected places.
The coal and oil industries have exploited two sets of beliefs about how knowledge is produced, postmodernism and Protestantism. These two ideas are in many ways philosophically opposed, but they nevertheless share one critical feature that makes widespread denial of scientific truth possible: an emphasis on individual experience.
It's a provocative argument, as always. And you can find that episode and every episode of Ministry of Ideas at ministryofideas.org. And you can find all the Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode soonish.